This is McKinsey Recruiting, a podcast created to help you learn more about McKinsey and Company. My name is Philip, and together with Sydney, our other podcast host, I'm here to answer all your questions about McKinsey Recruiting and introduce you to some of our McKinsey personalities. In this episode, we will talk about something that is especially important for us, our inclusive culture. Our guest today is Julia, a partner in our Frankfurt office who joined our firm in 2004. Julia will share why she cares deeply about diverse team settings and equal opportunities, why feedback is so important to her, and how all this relates to her degree in neurosciences. Are you ready? Then let's start our podcast, McKinsey Recruiting. Hi, Julia. Great to have you on board of our McKinsey Recruiting podcast, and a warm welcome from my living room in Cologne to your home office in Frankfurt.
Thank you very much, Philip. It's an utmost pleasure to be with you today.
Julia, I know that one of your favorite topics is nudging. That means small, thought-provoking impulses to influence behavior without relying on prohibitions or rules.
Wow, you said it perfectly. I'm impressed, Philip. You did your pre-work.
Yeah, so Julia, how would you recommend I begin our interview to apply these techniques correctly?
One nudge can definitely be around empathy and around building connections. So by just alluding to the fact that we both are in our home offices, you in your living room and I'm in mine, was already a quite a good one to get us started.
Okay.
And as you said, those are just little prompts that make it more likely for a certain behavior to get displayed. So the theory assumes that if there's motivation, so basically you're not against this behavior, right? There's nothing that would actually prevent me from being friendly to you because I actually like you and enjoy working with you. And I also have the capability. You're welcome. And I also have the general capability to be friendly, right? That's the other important hurdle we have to cross. So if there's motivation and there's capability, those little prompts, those nudges can make it just much more likely for behavior that is not unwanted to occur. Yeah.
So we had a good start.
Well done.
Okay. So something else, in my podcast research and by talking to some of your colleagues, I discovered that gratitude is extremely important to you. How do you incorporate this into your daily life? I've even heard that you send feedback voice messages to your teams.
Yeah, those are two different things. So sometimes these voice messages can also be not so grateful. But let's start with a gratitude piece. No. They mostly are. I'm a big believer in strength-based feedback, and I think that you can motivate people, in particular colleagues that we're having here around in McKinsey, even more so if you build on their strengths. So jokes aside, those voice messages are indeed rather encouraging than anything else. So yes, I'm a strong believer in gratitude, and in particular in building it into your day-to-day life. So the simple word of thank you, or the little unexpected note, the little act of kindness that was rather random, is something that's very easy to do, but can mean the world for other people around you. And the nice thing about saying thank you is that it makes both people feel better, the one that receives it and the one that gives it. So yes, I purposefully built this in my day.
That's also something very McKinsey typical. So we always say that we have a culture of feedback. However, I've heard also you prefer something called feed forward. Can you explain what this is all about?
Yeah, that's... basically, when you see someone behaving in certain ways, etc., and they ask you, hey, can you give me some feedback? The thing I say, yes, of course, I can share with you what I've observed and the effect it had, etc. But what I much more enjoy is, so what is it we're going to do with it jointly in the future? Because the past is the past, so you cannot really change it. So I always encourage my teams to obviously thoughtfully look back and see what worked, what hasn't worked, what they would do differently going forward, and just asking around what effects the behavior has had on the people around them, be it their own team or be it a client session. But then most importantly, I love this both immediate outlook into the future and say, like, okay, So starting tomorrow, mm-hmm. what is it that we're going to do differently? And what the people you might have spoken to might have wanted to also share is that I deeply enjoy thinking through with people also their future, their big next steps into their career, literally what it is that they want to create, what it is that they want to build while they're within McKinsey. And I enjoy these coaching conversations deeply and sometimes give them also unsolicitedly.
I can give you positive feedback at the moment. So thank you for joining us. And we'll be talking about one topic today, which is diversity.
Yeah.
And you are McKinsey's leader for our All In initiative, which engages colleagues around the world to develop and share innovative ways of working that advance inclusivity. Could you explain your role and the topics you are dealing with?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, as you know, I'm a partner with McKinsey and company, and I carry also another hat, which is the head of being the global partner lead for all mm-hmm. of our all-in efforts. And indeed, those are all the efforts of McKinsey, in particular related to gender diversity and inclusion. And in this role, I'm responsible for basically the designing of all our inclusion and diversity programs. That's one thing. And also the smaller interventions where we talked about nudges at the start. I think they're equally important. Thinking through how to make a team room experience more inclusive, thinking mm-hmm. through how a recruiting process, an interview process, an onboarding process can be made more inclusive. So in addition to the big programs around sponsorship, around structurally supporting those primary caregivers that return, for example, from a longer leave and need to revamp mm-hmm. into their client service, etc., etc. So in addition to these very structural programs, I also work a lot on these behavioral interventions.
Mm-hmm. What role plays mentorship and supporting others in that?
A very strong one. And over the years, I've actually almost abandoned the word mentorship and tried to replace it with sponsorship whenever possible. I tell you why. You might have already heard quite a bit that women tend to get, and it might be true for all talent, tend to get over-mentored but under-sponsored. So what does this mean? A mentor is someone who gives you good advice when you ask for it, right? It's someone who sits down for a coffee with you, who tells you about their career, what they have done, how they would behave if they were in your shoes. And that's something that can be truly helpful, but it's not enough. What you need, and that's why I say we've developed quite a rigid approach to sponsorship in McKinsey, is you also need this very person that does not only provide the coffee, but that then mm-hmm. also provides the client opportunity, that provides the opportunity for you to speak at a conference, for you to present in a meeting, for you to be the one to share back the latest numbers that you've just received coming out of your analysis, et cetera, et cetera. So a sponsor creates opportunities and ensures that you can shine in them when they emerge.
Okay, I see. Someone who really helps you with concrete opportunities in the end.
Yes, and takes a risk on you and says, you know, I have your back. We'll get through this together. I'll show you something that you can do. Why don't you want to? So exactly. And that goes beyond mentorship. I think it can still be helpful to also have mentors and get a diverse set of opinions. But in order to progress, you do need a good hand of sponsors.
And can you explain me, back coming to the All In initiative, why does McKinsey have such an initiative or why does it need such an initiative?
Mm. You might have seen a lot of the work that we've published externally, or started with Women Matter, it went into Diversity Matters. So very, very early on, more than a decade ago, we actually described the business case for diversity and even more so now inclusion. So, of course, we said if this is something that we in our own research with leading companies have found, we have to take our own medicine and also apply those very principles that we've identified as being essential for the progress of, you know, gender diversity inclusion to our own firm.
Okay, we're going to come back to the topic Women Matter and what it means for the economy a bit later. But can you give me an example of McKinsey's inclusive culture, especially when it comes to different perspectives and backgrounds.
Yeah, there's one thing which I find remarkable amongst the many others I could name now, which is that this obligation, we call it even the obligation to dissent, is so close to our hearts and even values in the firm. What does it mean? Is that we believe that it is not enough to have the right mind, the right intellect in the room. This intellect also needs to speak up at the right moment, irrespective of hierarchy, seniority, etc. So we do not only say, you business analyst who've just joined the team may in certain instances articulate your opinion. No, we actually say it is your very obligation from day one that when you find that there's something being said in the room that might not mirror what you found in your data, that might not fit with what you think is right, and you better have some facts and figures behind it, but what you think is not right, you are obliged to speak up.
So it's not just a right, it's an obligation to dissent.
Exactly so. Exactly so.
Okay. Thank you for that. Let's get to your career, because you completed a PhD degree in cognitive neuroscience at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research and were awarded with a research scholarship and electives at Harvard Medical School and the World Health Organization. Since your degree, you have lived and worked in many places around the world, for example, also a longer period in the Middle East, so you seem like quite the global citizen. If you reflect back to the time when you were studying in Germany compared to the path that brought you to where you are today, is this the path that you imagined your career to go, especially when you're coming from a medical background and now work at a consultancy?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's also a leading question. The obvious answer is no. When I studied medicine, I thought I'd become a physician. I realized quite early on, though, in my studies that I was somehow asking different questions. Sounds a bit funny, but different questions than my classmates. So I got very early then interested in the human brain, the inner workings. How do we make decision? What is real? What do we perceive? Versus what do we imagine, etc. So I got very early on interested in other fields, but pure curative medicine. And then what happened is, McKinsey was doing a study in Germany to help the educational system get better. And the way that we did it at the time, was that we invited leading thinkers from very different disciplines to come together for workshops and express what they from their discipline would give to the educational system. So there were philosophers, historians, and there were brain researchers. So at the time, the professor I was working with actually took me along. And it had been a really I still remember the evening, had been a really thought-provoking evening for me. And it was the time where for the first time met McKinsey, and McKinsey had been very good in then staying in touch with me afterwards. And I think what made the difference is that, in fact, it was a woman, a female partner working for the McKinsey at the time, who took a bit care of me over the years and always checked in. And one day she sat down with me for coffee and she said, you know, Julia, when you think about what you're doing in life, how big is your radius of impact? And I said, pardon me, what's radius of impact? Yeah, no, but basically what's your radius? And she repeated it, what's your radius of impact? So the best answer I had, well, I have an apartment, I go to the university clinic. If I'm not in the university clinic, I go to the Max Planck Institute or the scanning facility, as I was doing lots of functional magnetic resonance imagery at the time. So yes, it's, I don't know, maybe 2 kilometers, 3. So I think I gave her a numerical answer to more of a metaphoric question. In any case, my radius was small, right? And then she asked something else. She said, okay, wow, so that's the radius of your impact. And tell me, how many people in the world do still understand what it is you're doing your research on? And then my answer, and is this number getting bigger or smaller over the years? I was like, so yes, it might, you know, yes, of course, you become somewhat specialized. You can share your findings with others who do their research, but of course, there is a narrowing of the field. And then she said, well, what about actually talking to the ministers of health to design whole health system strategies, speaking to the CEO of hospitals to redesign the way that clinical service is being delivered in wards. What about talking to the leaders in decision-making processes and actually help those insights you have be deployed in real company, blah, 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 blah. So that actually brought me then, and it did one thing. It really lightened up the way that I thought about life, even, and about what I could become and what I could be doing. And with this in mind, so with this radius of impact in mind and the broadening of those that I can speak to about what I'm doing, I joined consulting.
So I joined McKinsey. So you haven't planned it all out when you were starting with your studies or finished?
Oh, by far, no. I would even say right now I haven't planned out my life fully. But there I had no. It was even, you see, when you study medicine, it's almost like, they're the good people. Those are the ones that study medicine and stick to the true nature of curing patients. And then there are the other ones who might go to, I don't know, private businesses, etc. So not only did I not consider, also my impression of what it would be like was very different from what it is today.
Great. Let's get back to the diversity topic. As we've already said, McKinsey studies consistently show that diverse teams perform better and companies with diverse executive boards have better financial results. Mm-hmm. Have you observed this while working with your clients or internally at McKinsey?
Very, very interesting one. Yes. So at all times, I observe that teams that have a diversity of thought, either be it because they're mixed gender or they have different ethnicities in their different cultural background, educational background, etc., come up with more, I'd say, innovative, but also more objective thoughts and decisions. So this is something I see day to day, and I'm sure my colleagues could attest to as well. It's not always, people might say it's not always the smoothest process, because of course, if you think like A and your teammate thinks like B, and then you have to find out what's the better result is. So there's always some little friction in intellectual friction in figuring out what is right, but the result is better. And I deeply enjoy this meeting of great minds when they come together and the output is a solution that's so much more convincing than what simply a Julia cloned 10 times could have come up with.
And following up on that, has there been a time in your career where you had to overcome a challenge that was a result of diversity? And what lessons did you learn from that?
Yeah, multiple times and different in their, I'd say, implicity or explicitness. So one thing I remember well is you mentioned already I spent significant time in the Middle East. So after I had started working in Germany and mainly consulted in the health system services field around hospitals, etc., there was an ask in the Middle East if I could bring this expertise of mine also to some healthcare providers there. So I was supposed to stay for 3 months for one study. I returned after, I think, 11 years. So there has been quite
a bit longer than expected.
A bit longer than expected. And I first, what I realized, and this goes both ways in terms of challenges, but also in terms of advantages that you can have when you are diverse as a profile. I remember well in the first country I worked in, we had a female health minister who was a fantastic leader at the time with a very bold vision on how the health system should advance in her country. Mm-hmm. And I'd say it's been a great advantage for me to also be a female leader in healthcare, etc., to connect with her and to build this rapport that we were having over the month and years. So there it has been helpful. The same happened to me when I then went to East Africa for half a year. I also had a female CEO there of the university hospital, also surrounded by a completely male team. And again, I think gender frankly even even helped me a bit. Where it didn't help is when I first, for the first time, entered Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And I think there also the firm was thinking, what can we do with her? Because this is now 10, whatever, longer, more than a decade back, and things were still very different. So I happened to be like the first mm-hmm. woman to ever enter this very ministry, or the first woman to ever speak to this very government figure or a private sector figure, etc. So there I felt I had to work extra hard to make a point that I have the right to be there and have the right to stay. Again, once you though have established your reputation, mm-hmm. you being somewhat different actually has a remarkable, memorable effect. So people more easily know about you, want to continue conversations with you. But it took more hard work, I'd say, than mm-hmm. it would have taken if I wouldn't have been that diverse.
I would love to listen to more of your personal experiences and stories. But I know that there is another topic beside nudging that we haven't talked about yet, which is called bias. Mm. And bias was also a main topic of your studies and is still a present topic today, also in your career. Could you explain what bias means and how we can or should tackle it head on? Do I have to be afraid of it?
No, you should be aware of it. No. You should be, if you start being aware of it, there's already a big step taken. So basically, bias exists, and it exists for a good reason, because it helps us survive. It helps us literally create patterns, identify stories quickly, and therefore also identify danger around us very quickly. So it helps us literally get through life on a day-to-day basis without having to have our attention everywhere at any point in time. So very concretely, you have to think that at any point in time, about 11 million bits of information hit your brain, and it can roughly consciously process about 70 of them, 50 of them. So you go down from 11 million bits to 70. With this big filtering exercise, of course, the brain makes mistakes. That's normal. There are errors in there. And those errors are bias. Where it becomes a bit more tricky is that when you're unaware of these bias, and research shows that those that are believing the most that they are actually objectives might be prone to the most biases. So that's why I was glad, Philip, that you already asked the question of should you be afraid of it? Yes, I mean, you should be afraid of it in the sense that if you want to build a team that has a lot of diversity, fresh ideas, innovation, etc. in it, and what you do is you tend to recruit little Philips over and over again, because you think, hey, you have been successful in your own way, so a mini version of you will do the same. So yes, indeed, it can be dangerous, because again, we like what reminds of ourselves, and that's a mini me bias. We tend to replicate our own leadership style over and over again, and it's the same. I realize I'm doing the same. So if I don't watch out for it, you suddenly see many Julias, male or female, around around in my team room, because there's a certain type of people that I enjoy mentoring, that I enjoy sponsoring. And before coming to other sets of biases, that's maybe the one single most important point where these structured sponsorship programs are so essential. Because mm-hmm. if you do not help people find their sponsor, what will happen is like a marketplace of bias. Yeah, those sponsors will pick those people whose company that they enjoy. And very often they enjoy the company of those that remind them of themselves. And suddenly you then have sponsors raising the same little versions of them over and over again. Yeah, there are other... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I would like to go one step further, because we have a lot of listeners who also are... in recruiting processes and also yeah. want to get some hands-on tips. Do you have any food for thought for groups or tips for women or minority groups that could help them in their career advancement?
Number one is be aware that you might be biased and people around you are, and not in a negative way with a negative intent. It's just the way that that our brain works. One thing I find remarkable, and that's something you should be aware of, is that you can also have biases against yourself. So basically, depending on what you get reminded or choose to remind yourself before an interview, can actually influence the outcome of your performance. So maybe as a tip, right before an interview, rather than thinking of all the reasons why you shouldn't be here and why we might have made a hiring mistake already by having you in the room, just think of, what is it? What is my natural strength? What is it that I can uniquely bring to this very place? What is it that I am proud of? And this kind of positive framing will help you then also be at the best version of yourself in the interview.
So thank you for that. I'll take from that I don't have to be afraid of it, but I should be aware of it.
Exactly.
Julia, now comes a new section in our podcast, which I would like to introduce now for the first time in McKinsey Recruiting. It's called Ask Me Anything, AMA. We want on the virtual streets with our podcast, in this case, to our virtual Next Generation Women Leaders event, where you also had a speaker slot and asked some participants what they want to know about McKinsey. So we've asked them that, and I would love to introduce you to those. So are you ready for your free Ask Me Anything questions?
Let's go.
Great. So the first question comes from Leticia. She studies in Holland and has a follow-up question on your keynote.
Hi, Julia. This is Leticia from Holland. During the Next Generation Women Leaders event, you mentioned the CV experiment where Heidi and Howard were evaluated differently, even though they had the exact same qualifications. I wanted to ask you how you have dealt with situations where your leadership skills were not valued because you're exhibiting them as a woman when they would have been appreciated if you were a man. Do you have any specific tips for us on how to find the balance between being assertive but not being seen as bossy?
Thank you, Leticia, for the question. Maybe first of all, what was this experiment all about? And do you have any tips for her?
Yeah, she's a wonderful question. And she's referring back to a double bind situation, which is the following, that when women tend to act in line with their stereotype, so when they are nice and friendly, polite, rather ask questions, speak with a soft voice, etc., they tend to be liked more, at least in experiments and studies. Mm-hmm. When they do the exact opposite, though, they're not liked so much. However, if you are not assertive, if you do not speak up, if you're not taking the first air space in the room, you will more likely also have a less chance to be seen as a leader. So this kind and polite and friendly person is a great colleague, but the moment that people ask, and is she's going to be your future boss, the answer is going to be rather a bit silent. And this very experiment reflects this. So they took two CVs, one of a man, one of the woman. Otherwise, they weren't identical. So literally just changed the name of the applicant, and then asked students if they would like to work with a person. And the same CV was called Howard's CV, received, oh yes, he knows what he wants. He's bold. He's decisive. I want to follow him. And the female CV, which was Heidi's CV, again, identical, just a different name on top, is when being asked, would you follow this woman? The feedback was more nuanced, saying maybe she's a bit too focused on herself and her own career progression, etc. So same CV, different gender names, yielded a completely different response with regards to the willingness of people to follow. Now, have I experienced this? Yes, I think people are harsher in their feedback towards me when I become assertive and bolder in making my points. That's something that I have realized, but that did not stop me from making them. I think the recipe here is to find your own leadership style, some sort of very centered way of leading, and then going with it if irrespective, if it means that you're assertive, it means that you're loud, well, that's then you. The one thing you shouldn't do is you should not try to pretend to be someone else or try to be nice when you aren't, or try to be assertive when you actually wanted to ask a question, because this non-authenticity is something that will shine through. So, a rather long answer to your question. So yes, of course, I have experienced this, and I'm sure many, many people, many leaders have. And my recipe towards it is that I just became very centered in the way that who I am and how I lead, that these reactions can actually not throw me off track.
Okay. So Leticia, I hope that has answered your question. The second question of our Ask Me Anything comes from Sheetal. She studies business in France.
Hi, I'm Sheetal from France. I'm currently a business student, and I want to know how the resumes are screened at McKinsey. Is each resume personally screened by a recruiter, or is there an ATS system?
Classic recruiting question. How are our recruiters working? Is McKinsey looking at every CV?
Yeah. Yes. So CVs are being looked at one by one individually. Of course, we are also increasingly using technology in our recruiting process. One example is we've designed a digital game for our participants, which tests problem solving in a non-business environment. So we can also identify the talent that has the great intrinsics, but might not be as close to business yet as some other candidates.
Okay. Thank you for your answer. Sheetal, I hope that has answered your question. And our third question comes from Ayomi. She has a background as medical student in London.
Hello, my name is Ayomi Dayorinde, and I'm a medical student from Imperial College in London. My question is this: how should students who don't have conventional internships or work experience approach the McKinsey application process, and how do they leverage themselves for these opportunities? Thank you.
So, interesting question. Is McKinsey looking at experience differently when someone doesn't have experience in consulting or doesn't come from a business school background, for instance, as a medical student like Ayomi?
Yeah, or like I was at the time. So a great, great question again. When we look at our candidates, we look at what has been, you know, their very personal impact. What's their entrepreneurial drive, yeah? Where have they really gone for an opportunity, created something, achieved something? And do we see any early signs or mature signs of leadership already? And that's something that you can show no matter what it is that you've studied. So when you then ask me about how should I best prepare for the McKinsey interviews, I'm a bit torn. I have to tell you, I myself, as a medical student, I think I read every single business case that was ever written in the world, just to make sure I understood the logic and how to go about it. It might have been a waste of my time, but it gave me a certain, I don't know, it gave me a certain confidence walking into the interview process that I would not get surprised by a business question. Did it help in any way the outcome? Other than that, I don't think so, because as I said, those markers that we look for in our candidates, they can be shown in so many different ways and forms that have nothing to do with a business environment.
Okay. Thank you for answering also the third question. Ayomi, I hope also that this answer that you feel answered. I want to have the right to have the last question of our interview. Now we've heard our free Ask Me Anything questions. If you know the classic McKinsey technique of top-down communication, where you sum up the key message of what you want to say, preferably, of course, at the beginning of a presentation, this should be no problem for you, Julia. The question is, what is it that you would like our listeners to get out of our podcast episode today?
Continue to be this very unique profile that you are, and don't try to adapt any other leadership style, features, etc., just because the world around you might show some bias. So stay unique and stay centered and on the road towards finding your own leadership profile.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of today's recruiting podcast episode. Thank you, Julia, for this deep dive into diversity. It was a pleasure to get to know you further and introduce you to our listeners.
Thank you very much, Philip. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you have more questions or ideas for our show, drop us a line on our podcast page, mckinsey.com/recruitingpodcast. To learn more about our diversity recruiting efforts, how to apply, and tons of other information, check out mckinsey.com/careers.